from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, drones are taking a major role in President Obama's national security efforts, which is surprising to some and sensible to others. But it's safe to say that all around, using drones raises big moral questions about transparency of war, civilian casualties, and setting geopolitical precedents. We'll discuss the morality and present reality and future of drones. It's all coming up next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. On the 4th of June, a drone strike in Pakistan's northwest region killed Libyan Abu Yayad al-Libi, the alleged second-in-command of al-Qaeda. President Obama has continued to escalate the use of drones, unmanned aerial vehicles that can be remotely piloted from thousands of miles away in a number of countries, including Yemen, Iraq, and Somalia and Afghanistan. That's despite criticism from human rights groups, especially also from Pakistan. And in this opening Forum Hour, we want to look into the growing use of drone warfare and drone production and take up the debate over drones. Joining us first is Daniel Kleidman, and he's special correspondent with Newsweek and with the Daily Beast, author of a book called Kill or Capture, The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. And Daniel Kleidman, good to have you with us on Forum. Good morning.
Thanks for having me. Good morning to you.
Well, I guess I'd like to begin by talking with you about your book, because you talk about the lawyer-in-chief, as you call him, and also the president as a kind of efficient terrorist killer. But this goes back to sort of your own experiences serving Newsweek in Jerusalem in 1999 when there were targeted killings done by the Israelis. We've taken kind of a giant step from there. I mean, we're not only doing targeted killings, but we're doing signature killings. And please give us a sense of the distinction between the two.
Well, yeah, it is interesting. I mean, I covered the beginnings of the Intifada, the second Intifada in 2000 in Jerusalem when I was bureau chief there. And I can remember the Israelis doing these targeted killings. Often they were helicopter strikes. And the American ambassador at the time was Martin Indyk. He said quite publicly he called them extrajudicial killings, and that our government did not support the policy, even though we had such a close relationship with the Israelis. I do remember the Israelis at the time saying quietly, just wait until you guys are victims of the kind of terrorism that we've experienced. All of a sudden, this capability might start looking more attractive. And I guess that in some ways was prescient. But Barack Obama actually learns about the distinction between signature strikes and personality strikes, as they're called, really on his third day of office, January 23rd, 2009. He learns from his chief counterterrorism advisor that the very first drone strikes that were fired on his presidency, one of them killed a tribal elder in Pakistan who was a pro-peace Pakistani, and also much of his family was killed. They simply got the wrong people. And the president was quite disturbed by this. He had heard about the astonishing precision of this weaponry. And here he was, 3 days into office, the president who was going to change the message to the Muslim world, presiding over the deaths of innocent Muslims. He called in the CIA leadership later that afternoon, or actually the next afternoon, and wanted them to go through with him how this had happened. The deputy CIA director, a man by the name of Steve Kappas, begins explaining to him about signature strikes, something that the president really didn't know anything about. A signature strike is essentially a drone strike on or it can be other kinds of – it can use other kinds of munitions as well. But a drone strike in this case on a large group of men where you don't know the precise identity of the individual men. But there are certain characteristics, defining characteristics associated with terrorism which make you strongly believe that this is a legitimate target. the president is hearing about this and he's trying to wrap his mind around it, and he cuts off Kappas and says, well, that's just not good enough for me. But meanwhile, he's continuing to listen to this kind of tense back and forth about these kinds of strikes. And over time, he's persuaded that this is a reasonable policy in Pakistan, where he's told that the United States, after having operated there for 8 years by then, had such good intelligence, such good human intelligence essentially, that the risk of killing a lot of civilians was not that great. And he decides to approve these kinds of signature strikes under the CIA program. And it's an important inflection point in his presidency. One last thing I'll say about this is that at the same time, the military, which has its own targeted killing program and was quite aggressive and wanted to go after suspected terrorists in places like Yemen and Somalia, also was pushing to do signature strikes. But the president held the line with regard to the military and would not allow those kinds of strikes in Yemen and Somalia for most of his first 3 years of this term. He's begun to relent, however, particularly in Yemen.
Well, relent is putting it mildly in many ways. I mean, the escalation of the use of drones is unprecedented, and it far exceeds what was done during the Bush administration. I'm also struck by, in reading your book about John Brennan, who's been one of the president's main advisors and help in making these decisions, talking about how high the bar is. But that's mainly for targeted killings and not signature killings. And the fact is, we don't really know how much collateral damage there's been, do we?
It's very hard to know precisely how much collateral damage there has been. There's no question that significant numbers of women and children have been killed, and non-combatants, I should say, have been killed in these drone strikes over the past few years. The question, I guess, is what are the alternatives? One alternative conceivably would be to go in on the ground. We can't operate, or have not been able to, or have chosen not to operate on the ground in Pakistan, except in limited circumstances. There are people who would argue that putting troops in on the ground, the chaos of that kind of very close, up-close warfare would lead to more casualties than drone strikes. Alternatively, you can do airstrikes, which we do from time to time, have done in Afghanistan. Those also are not particularly precise, and we've killed a lot of civilians in that way. So I guess the larger question then becomes, should we be fighting a military war against terrorism? And that's a big question.
Yeah, there are a lot of big questions here. There's a big question about executive power, and there's a big question about the morality of killing innocents with these drones, and also about the concern that many have about selling them to allies, or not even necessarily to allies. They may come back, blow back and get us, because now, especially with making cheaper and smaller drones, they're going to be probably accessible to terrorists.
Yeah, blowback is a real concern, and it is a something that in the course of reporting my book, I would hear officials bring that issue up. I've been told that the president was concerned about blowback as well, although there's not a lot to suggest that concerns about blowback ended up being persuasive for him. I remember interviewing a Defense Department official at one point who was making this very point about blowback and about the proliferation of this kind of tactic. And this person talked about, what if the Chinese decided that they wanted to go after those people who they consider to be terrorists in China? So, for example, the Uyghurs, who we regard as dissidents, who are fighting for their own, freedom in China, but the Chinese regard them as terrorists. We have Uyghur communities. I think there's some in California. There's a Uyghur community in Northern Virginia. How would we feel if the Chinese began targeting Uyghurs with drone strikes in these places? I think that's highly unlikely. And of course, we have very good air defenses, and drones are not a serious military threat to the United States. But the basic principle stands, that if we are doing it and we are setting this precedent, then others will decide that they have the justification for doing it as well. You know, that is also the history of warfare. You know, there has always been, you know, a kind of arms race, and once certain kinds of techniques are developed, it's very hard to keep them limited to just you know, a couple of countries.
Well, again, it's sort of the genie out of the bottle, isn't it? We're talking, by the way, with Dan Kleidman, who is special correspondent for Newsweek and the Daily Beast and author of Kill or Capture, The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. And it seems that we can conclude, at least at this point, that drones, at least with the Obama presidency, are here to stay, becoming more elastic. And what about transparency?
Well, that's a really big issue and very important. And I think that particularly with the drone program, where at this point, you know, there's very little, you know, it is a technically it is a covert program. But when a drone is fired at a some compound in Pakistan or some training camp in Yemen, in our you know, very small world, media saturated world, you know, people know about it instantly, practically.
Well, and maybe so a covert program, but you have quite a number of sources here that you were privy to.
Yeah. And look, I mean, I think one reason that the program itself was covert was to give diplomatic and political cover to the Pakistanis. But at this point, the idea of Pakistani cover for the drone program, you know, seems sort of farcical to me. And I think the administration actually struggles with this issue. I think the White House is under a lot of institutional pressure to keep the program secret. I think this happens to all administrations. The CIA wants to keep its crown jewels as secret as possible. I think the administration does believe that there ought to be more transparency. You've seen evidence of that going back to 2010 when Harold Coe, the State Department legal advisor, gave his first speech on the subject, talking about the legal rationale and justification for these strikes. And then subsequently, Attorney General Eric Holder giving speeches, the top lawyer at the Defense Department, and most recently, John Brennan, the president's chief counterterrorism advisor, giving a speech about drones in which he acknowledged that we were firing these drones in places like Pakistan.
Well, you mentioned Harold Coe. I can't help thinking about all the irony of him being such a human rights advocate and major figure and then saying, well, somehow I've metamorphosed here into a guy who's maybe involved in the killing of innocent people.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating aspect of this book. Harold Coe, the former dean of the Yale Law School, probably the most revered human rights lawyer of his generation, who railed against the Bush-Cheney policies during those years, in his position as the top lawyer at the State Department, actually is expected to, is allowed to, wanted to weigh in on these killing decisions, not for the CIA program, where that's all done internally by their own lawyers, but for the military program. And, you know, if you are a lawyer, you know, you having been in academia, when you go to the government, you do play something of a different role. You can't simply bring all of your academic views into government and say that that's that all of them have to stand.
Suddenly you're looking at kill lists and baseball cards with people who are targets. Yeah.
Exactly. All of a sudden, you know, Harold Coe is in these secure teleconferences. They're called civets meetings with maybe 75 people from across the national security bureaucracy. 45 minutes before, he may have gotten these baseball cards, which are essentially PowerPoint slides that have a picture of the suspected terrorist and all of the data on the other side. And the intelligence supporting the strike, and then you're in these meetings, and you know I describe these meetings, they're essentially kill meetings, as you know, in great detail. And what was striking about it was, particularly for someone like Harold Coe, there is this kind of inexorable kind of grinding momentum toward more killing. The military is You know, they have all of this jargon, and they are able to create this sort of sense of do or die urgency, and it's very difficult in some ways. There's a kind of a social pressure toward more killing, and I think Coe found it difficult to kind of resist that. And yet, this is important to say, he did on many occasions, push back on particular operations. There were long fights between him and his counterpart at the Defense Department, a man named Jay Johnson, over individual strikes. There was one case in particular, a high-ranking member of the Shabab ended up in a secure conference call between Jay Johnson, Harold Coe, and the top lawyer for the National Security Council at the White House. And ultimately, Johnson, who believed that this person could be killed, Harold Coe said, well, if you do this, the State Department would consider it an unlawful killing, and it didn't happen. Now, more often than not, these killings were approved, but there were vigorous debates and debates over the law and the morality and questions about whether it was the appropriate policy in some instances as well.
Dan Kleidman is with us from New York City. He's special correspondent with Newsweek and The Daily Beast and author of Kill or Capture, The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. Medea Benjamin is co-founder of Code Pink and also of Global Exchange and author of a new book on drones called Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. Good morning, Medea.
Michael, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, glad to have you on. And I know you want to make the public increasingly aware of, well, what essentially is an anti-drone movement or against this robotic warfare. What about the argument that this increases our national security? It gets rid of those who would do harm to the United States.
Well, it doesn't. I mean, here we are 10 years on and drones have been used for many years now. And they are not leading to an end of al-Qaeda or the Taliban. They're creating more enemies faster than we can kill them, as well as setting a terrible precedent for other countries around the world about killing people wherever we want, whenever we want.
And I don't know if you're familiar with the new weaponry, Medea, but there was a piece in the Los Angeles Times, a new generation of drones. They're like model planes, and they can pack tiny explosive warheads that can be delivered with pinpoint accuracy. You can put them in a rucksack. It struck me in reading about this that in using this kind of warfare, and I mentioned this to Dan Kleidman, we may be setting ourselves up for blowback of serious nature.
Well, that's right. Unfortunately, what goes around comes around. And these drones are being produced not only by the United States, but by Israel, by China, and other countries. Israel alone is exporting them to 50 different countries. And as you say, all sizes, all shapes. And this is going to come back to haunt us in the future.
Well, what do you suppose can be done at this point? Because it seems like, in fact, from your way of thinking, I imagine President Obama is completely sold on this policy.
Well, this is certainly his way of waging war, and it's become the Taliban's and al-Qaeda's number one way of recruiting. I think we have to find a way to internationally call for a ban on the use of lethal drones. I think we in the United States have to start discussing this issue and reining in our president. I think the Congress, instead of getting all up in arms about where the leaks on this information are coming from, should get up in arms about a program that is not making us safe and killing innocent people. So we have a lot to do to educate people and get the dialogue going, and that's why it's great you're doing this program.
And you would be, I presume, all in favor of transparency, especially with collateral damage?
Well, I think it's terrible that our government doesn't tell us what it's doing, doesn't do any kind of accounting of the innocent people who are killed. There's no transparency, no accountability, and I think it's time that we start demanding that.
Medea Benjamin, again, is the author of Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. She's co-founder of Code Pink and Global Exchange. And I want to bring Tom Hendrickson into this. He's senior fellow at Hoover Institution at Stanford. His most recent book is American Power After the Berlin Wall. Good morning, Tom Hendrickson.
Good morning.
Let's get your perspective on this. I mean, the sense is, particularly with Pakistan, despite what may be deemed treachery on their part with respect to the dealings with the United States geopolitically, is becoming more militant. The drone use is getting us farther away from any kind of really serious positive dealings with Pakistan and making more enemies for us.
Well, there is a possibility that the drone can be overused and it will destabilize the country. That's certainly a consideration. However, that said, it has been very effective in dismantling al-Qaeda. It's taken down many of the top leaders. Now, whether there's a new group will come up and it'll be just as effective as the old ones, that's another matter. But those who are opposed to it on all these different ways, such as moral issues and so forth, have to come up with a better policy. The United States certainly tried a policy of invasion, regime change, and nation building in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. It's hugely expensive in terms of blood and treasure. So the drone is an answer to dealing with terrorism in remote areas, which spares us a lot of young men and young women being killed in those places going over there, plus a lot of money. So it has a certain effectiveness.
And the fact that this comes at the cost of innocent civilians being killed. We can't really calculate or distinguish half the time combatants from non-combatants with the signature weaponry that we use.
That's true. There are, and those things are to be deplored and to be certainly worked against as much as possible. On the other hand, the United States is not dealing with carpet bombing. We're not doing what we did in World War II. We're firebombing a place like Tokyo and Dresden and so forth. So it's a much more humane, if you can make war humane at all, in a more narrow scope, to take out just those who are directly responsible for attacks on Americans and other people.
It's escalated, though. I mean, for a while, we were using drones largely, actually, with surveillance of Iraq, and then they extended into Afghanistan. Now, though to a limited extent, they're in Somalia and Yemen, too. What about the whole question of sovereignty and the advisability of this kind of infringement of sovereignty?
Well, it's a new kind of war. And, you know, we actually did something like this for many, many years, not with drones, but the whole bombing campaign that went on in Iraq after the first Persian Gulf War. The United States was involved in a kind of hot war during a time of peace when we were bombing Saddam's defense systems before the invasion in 2003. So that went on, and there were voices raised against it from time to time, but I think it's been breached a certain degree, the idea of sovereignty, and the fact we're dealing also with very weak or even failed states who can't, in fact, stop al-Qaeda forces from penetrating, such as in Somalia and Yemen, and even in the remote parts of Pakistan. So we're left with an option that if we don't do something about it, and these states aren't capable of doing themselves, then we're leaving ourselves vulnerable for more attacks.
My thanks to Tom Hendrickson and Medea Benjamin, and we're going to continue this discussion with Daniel Kleidman, again, the author of Kill or Capture, The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. And with you, our listeners, we'd like to hear what you have to say about drone use. We'd like to welcome your questions and comments and have you join this conversation. Our toll-free number is available to you now. It's 866-733-6786, so feel free to join the program, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment, or you can join us by going to our Facebook page. And I want to mention that yesterday in the Los Angeles Times, they talked about these pint-sized but lethal switchblade drones. They could shorten the kill chain, and they could delegate actually responsibility to lower-level soldiers on the ground. How do you feel about drones? Feel free to join us. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The topic this hour is drones, and drones are taking a major role in President Obama's national security efforts, which to some is surprising and some sensible and others certainly of concern. We've heard different points of view. We were talking with Medea Benjamin earlier, co-founder of Code Pink and Global Exchange, who's written a new book called Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. Tom Hendrickson also joined us from Stanford, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and His most recent book is American Power After the Berlin Wall. And our guest for the hour is Daniel Kleidman, who's with us from New York, senior correspondent for both Newsweek and the Daily Beast, and author of Kill or Capture, The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. And I wanted to say also that because when I went to the break, I was talking about a piece in yesterday's Los Angeles Times that said the Pentagon is going to be deploying these pint-sized but lethal Switchblade drones. And I want to mention that just to clarify what we're talking about again. It's a 2-foot-long Switchblade, also called a kamikaze drone, because the wings are folded into the fuselage for transport, and they spring out after launch. And as I said, it could be actually carried right in a soldier's rucksack. The problem is that defense contractors really are developing these smaller and cheaper and more high-powerful high-tech weapons in guerrilla warfare for, I suppose, the present century. And again, finding out what your thoughts are about drones and getting your comments and questions, you can join us by email, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or, of course, communicate with us on our Facebook page. Here's some emails. Here's John Antioch, who says, great show as usual. Thank you, John. And he says, why is it that those people driving the drones can't tell the difference between terrorist gatherings and weddings? Seems like every time they make a mistake and kill lots of innocent people, it's because they mistakenly bombed a wedding. Daniel Kleidman?
Well, it is interesting. There have been a number of these wedding gatherings which have been confused by targeters as terrorist gatherings. I think often those have been more conventional bombings from airplanes as opposed to drone strikes. At least that's my recollection. So that doesn't go to the in fact, you could argue that a drone operator would be much more likely to be able to tell the difference between a wedding and a a terrorist gathering, because remember, the drones do have these cameras. They do linger over the targets for quite some time before they strike, which isn't to say they don't make mistakes, because gatherings of military age males, as they call them, are often just gatherings of men and not terrorists. But that's more likely to happen, though, with conventional strikes.
Well, here's one of our listeners, Frank, who comments on our Facebook page. The use of drones is neither ethical nor unethical. It's just a tool to do the killing. If the killing is ethical, then I'd think the use of drones in that case is also ethical. And these are big moral questions, but there's also that question I alluded to before, Daniel Kleidman. I would like your take on it, and that is about executive power. I mean, to a great extent, the president and really the two others that he's been working with for the most part, as you outline in your book or as you present to us, but mainly the president, the executive power here. Gary Wills has written a whole book on this, the idea that the commander-in-chief pretty much at will and with his own discretion and his own judgment completely can send out hits.
Well, look, the president, under Article 2 of the Constitution, does have the power to make targeting decisions. So as a legal proposition, I don't think there's a there's an issue with Obama himself approving these kill decisions. The question is it good policy, and does it make sense for a president to be so involved individually in these kinds of strikes? Do you want a president to have a kind of to be more detached and not to have the kind of emotional involvement that you might have from being involved in these strikes? It's interesting with Obama. What I learned in my reporting on these kill lists and his own personal involvement in these decisions was he was doing it not because he thought there was not enough killing going on and that he wanted to be more involved in making sure that they were getting more people. It was sort of the opposite. He was doing it because he saw himself as a restraining force on the military. And he seemed to have supreme confidence in his own judgment. He was concerned that military action has a way of kind of spinning out of control. And he was worried about opening up new fronts in the war on terrorism. And when he first came into office, remember, he had inherited a military that had been shaped by George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and Dom Rumsfeld, which was very much – very aggressive, very much on the go. And they wanted to do more of these signature strikes, particularly in Yemen and Somalia. And he was worried about that. He was worried about mission creep. And so he was trying to constrain some of that activity. I think he also believed that these were consequential decisions, and the president needed to assume some personal moral responsibility for it. But over time, as we saw, the numbers just got, you know, increased with more and more of these strikes.
Well, here's a listener who gives us a note of skepticism, to be sure, a professor of economics in the East Bay, who writes, "All drone strikes are not equal. Please ask your guests about targeting U.S. citizens, beginning with Anwar al-Awlaki. The Obama administration has asserted their right to unilaterally kill U.S. citizens with no judicial review of any kind. How long before heavily Republican districts in the United States are targeted? And President Obama claims to be a constitutional lawyer."
Yeah, that's an issue that is very troubling to a lot of Americans, the idea that a U.S. citizen could be targeted for death without, you know, his or her Fifth Amendment rights and the kind of due process that you normally get. What you will hear from the administration is that these are this is not a criminal process. This is war, and acts of and going after someone like Anwar al-Awlaki, who has demonstrated a desire and a capability to attack civilians in America, is a legitimate target of war.
You made clear in your book, President Obama, really became focused in almost an unusual way on al-Awlaki. I mean, he wanted him dead.
Very, very much so. The president, after bin Laden was killed, Ayman Zawahiri took over as the number one of the central organization of al-Qaeda. The president was less concerned about Zawahiri and more concerned with al-Awlaki, who wasn't even the leader of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the Yemeni affiliate of al-Qaeda.
No, but he was doing all these videos and having a great influence.
But he was both a charismatic recruiter of potential terrorists, both because of his fluent English, American accented English, his use of the internet, and a kind of charisma that he had. But he had also become operational and was the intelligence that the president knew about and that most Americans didn't at the time. Al-Awlaki was deeply involved in operations. He was the essentially the external operator for AQAP, and the president was less interested in.
Excuse me, that's Al Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula.
That's right, and that's right, and he was almost obsessed with getting Anwar al-Awlaki. He became sort of like the bin Laden, Obama's bin Laden, in a way. After bin Laden was killed, he was so adamant about getting al-Awlaki that in this one instance, at least as far as I was able to tell, he told his counterterrorism aides that he would be willing to consider the risk of collateral damage as long as they could get him. Not that he had made a decision that he was willing to allow civilians to be killed, but he didn't want his options to be foreclosed because there was a potential for civilians being killed.
Yeah, I want to read actually a web comment here that's right on target, so to speak. A listener named Crisco who says, "I'm disturbed by the killing of al-Awlaki's 16-year-old American citizen son, who I think had a Facebook page. There was also the 16-year-old who attended a drone conference in Pakistan to be trained on filming the aftermath of drone attacks. He was killed by a drone attack 3 days after the conference. There are reports of drone attacks on the people who come to the aid of those targeted in immediately prior drone attacks, and there have been many reports of drone attacks at funerals of militants killed in earlier drone attacks, and this is unacceptable." Let me bring our callers into this. And Adid, do I have your name pronounced right? Caller from Odeed?
Good morning, yes.
Yes, sir, you're on the air.
So as an ex-soldier in the Israeli military, I should tell you that we're in war, and where there, especially in war against terrorism, there's always a need for a lot of reconnaissance and a lot of intelligence gathering. And that's what most of the drones are doing. Now, when you do that, the ability to strike immediately upon that gathering is tremendous strength. And so diminishing that ability obviously is a problem. And that's only a comment, more importantly, as one that had to face that.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call. There's a soldier who, as I suppose many soldiers can testify, finds drone use valuable. And some more soldiers with this new technology are going to be using drones themselves, actually. Next caller is Ide. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Well, the problem is we are setting a very bad standard. I have no love. I think the Al-Qaeda people have caused more damage to people of the Middle East, people of the Muslim world, and they deserve everything they get. The fact is there is awful lot of civilians that have been killed, and calling for collateral damage is very, very inappropriate. These are people that were killed. And it's like a Medusa. You kill one, you grow another 10. And in fact, a lot of people that normally will not be sympathetic to this terrible group become sympathetic when their kids get killed. And the last thing I like to say, how do we keep it from happening here? You know, we don't, because we have China making this thing, we have other countries making this thing. This liberal slope, and I'm sure Obama have another failure of his, and really he should handle back his Peace Prize win, because he does not deserve it. He's causing a lot of harm to the American people.
All right. Thank you for that statement. Actually, I keep coming back to blowback, Dan Kleinman, and Iran now has one of our drones. I mean, I don't know what that bodes. Some thoughts from you on that?
Yeah, they do. A drone went down. They captured it. They're obviously studying the technology. You know, I don't think that, as you put it, the genie is out of the bottle. I think many countries will have this capability fairly soon. And how we deal with that is, I think is an important question. On the other hand, I'm just stating this as a reality. I think it's hard to imagine an American president not availing himself or herself of this weapon, of this capacity. George W. It is true that President Obama has approved many more drone strikes than were ever fired under George W. Bush, but that's only because the technology has gotten better, but really because the intelligence improved. By 2008, George Bush was ramping up drone strikes in Pakistan, and if he had been or if John McCain had been elected, I have no doubt that that would have continued. And I suspect whoever comes after this president is going to be seduced by this technology. Why? Because you do have the ability to go after individual suspected terrorists who are you believe to be plotting against Americans.
But let's be frank, it's also a lot cheaper.
But it's cheaper not just in a monetary sense. You don't have to put American troops on the ground.
Yeah.
And you don't have to occupy countries. It's just a you do this from thousands of miles away, which adds its own potential problem, which is that, you know, perhaps it sort of dulls the moral sensibilities of the people who – it makes killing so much easier. That's what makes it seductive. It
becomes like a video game for not necessarily. I'm not trying to in any ways necessarily speak derogatory about those who make these decisions, but it could certainly be reduced to that level.
But let me speak to that, because I have a scene in my book where – you know, Harold Koh, again, just to remind the listeners, who is the top lawyer at the State Department, and he is in 2010 getting ready to give a speech in front of a group of international lawyers, really the first time the administration publicly spoke about the drone program and made a legal defense of the policy. Before doing that, he wants to ensure himself that this is a program that is being done according to both domestic and international law. He goes over to the CIA and he meets with drone operators. And he's a fairly blunt guy, not always the most tactful person. And he says to this drone operator, I hear you guys have a sort of PlayStation mentality. Well, the drone operator is quite offended. He points out that he had been an Air Force pilot when he would drop bombs during war, he said, you know, I would drop my payload. I didn't know exactly who was down there, beneath me. Now I watch the target for hours. I can see the suspected terrorist playing with his children. Perhaps his wife is around. You know, I want to blow this guy to kingdom come, but I'm not going to do it when he's surrounded by his family. And then after I strike the target, you know, I might see the wife or a mother come out. I might see them in mourning position. I might then watch the funeral afterwards. I'm not morally detached from this. I can see it happening. Now, this is his point of view. And the point that he's making is it isn't video games. This is up close. At least you can see things happening in the way you can't in more conventional warfare.
Well, apropos of families, I'm looking at an email from a listener named Rick who writes, when your guest mentions collateral damage, I wonder if he means that in Pakistan, the Taliban leaders live with their extended families. If so, and if this is the excuse for taking the target, this target off of the list, it's easy to see the result. The Taliban will always travel with a few kids and wives as a shield in their battle against the West, and this is used by the Palestinians in their terror attacks against the Israelis. Another listener writes, this is Carl, if the drone attacks are stopped and there is another 9/11 type attack on America, what would those opposed to drone warfare want the government to do in response? And I want to get more of your calls on here. Richard, thank you for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Thanks very much, Michael. Incredibly interesting discussion. I've been in and out of the security industry for about 25 years. I also have the lucky distinction of speaking against the war in Iraq on the green in New Haven with Harold Coe back in the day. I just want to make a couple of quick points. You made the some that I was going to say, but the main one is that if we remember back in the darker days, the beginning of the war on Iraq, the collateral damage of civilians, the first some of the first numbers after the second year of the war were 78,000. Some of the others were 150,000. It is, in fact, a matter of degrees. And if this is going to be what war is going to be like, i.e. terrorists, and I really do understand the gravity of that word and how it can be misused and how it can be misapplied. But when we have been attacked and the people are living in small enclaves, small cells, these involve families, this involve extended families, cousins, brothers, and so on. It is a matter of degrees as to who and how around them is going to either, as the gentleman said before, the pilots can actually see some of those things. And again, it's not always perfect, but who and how dies around them is still a smaller, you'll forgive me, a smaller number in the matter of degrees than the larger idea of a war with boots on the ground, not to mention our people dying and thousands wounded. Well, thanks very much. It is a different kind of war. I'm so sorry that it exists, but this seems to be a better way. I'm also happy that it is a thoughtful person and a conscious person who is wrestling with this subject in the White House. Rather than perhaps someone who beats a drum faster.
All right. I thank you indeed for your opinion, and we'll get another caller on right away. And that's Jason from Iowa City. Join us, please. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I really agree with what a previous caller said. I think he made some excellent points. I just want to expand on what he said. I personally don't see how these drone strikes are benefiting us. I mean, after the Republic about degrees of people being killed, who's around them, it seems to me that even one person being killed is too many. I mean, you're in front of a terrorist, you see your dad get blown away, and your relatives who are innocent get blown away. It seems to me that it's going to create more terrorists. It seems to me part of fighting a war is winning the hearts and minds. I don't see how killing innocent people helps to that cause. And that's all I have to say.
Well, I'm glad you said it, and I thank you. And some more emails here that are appropriate and right on are in line with our conversation. Eric writes, the hubris of the whole drone debate is the implicit assumption that the United States will always be the only country with effective drones. Eventually, other countries or groups will use them against us, and when we protest, they will point to our own use of them. Another listener, Ben, writes, I don't suppose there will ever be a time in my life when my government won't be targeting someone somewhere who is planning to attack America or issuing calls to do so. That means we now accept that the president will be more or less continuously casting bolts from Olympus. I despair, but I also don't see much possibility, let alone likelihood, of turning back. What a world we have created. And Owen writes, my daughter-in-law is a human rights attorney who has spent several years as a defense lawyer for Guantanamo prisoners. Her current work is to test the legality of the targeted killings of U.S. citizens and others. She doesn't argue that many of those killed aren't enemies of this country, but simply wants to apply both constitutional and international rules to the expanding targeting programs. She has twice been invited to speak to military symposia to make the case against these programs, which would seem to indicate that at least the military is concerned about the moral issues raised by drone warfare. And Faith raises a question, Dan Kleidman. Says, if I understood Dan Kleidman correctly, the CIA is allowed to use drones, but the Army is not. What's the reasoning behind this?
Oh, no, that's not quite right. Both the CIA and the military use drones. They both engage in targeted killings. The distinction is that the CIA program is a covert program. In fact, in that program, they don't go to the president for approval of individual targeted killings. He has signed a covert a presidential finding which authorizes the program more generally. The military, however, does go to the president for approval of individual strikes. That's something that Obama insisted on. But both the CIA and the military have these programs.
And more of your calls. We go to Josh. Josh, thanks for waiting. Join us, please.
Good morning. The two previous callers kind of touched both ends of my question, which is basically when you're dealing with non-state players who are heavily favoring asymmetric tactics, and you have to find a way to address that from a tactical standpoint and also from a moral standpoint, you know, what I see is people we call terrorists using devices we call IEDs. And when we're seeing civilians being killed in the process of these devices being used, and we're seeing our own soldiers being killed in the process of these devices being used, I don't really see, and I guess my question is, what choice do we have to try and fight this fight without taking another asymmetric tactic into the environment?
Thoughts on that, Dan Kleidman?
Yeah, well, I think in some ways you've crystallized the views of President Obama. I don't think he sees drone warfare necessarily as a strategic weapon in the war on terrorism. And by that I mean I don't think he thinks that you can kill all the terrorists and end the ideology that ends up in young nihilistic men wanting to kill a lot of Americans. I do think he thinks it's an important tactical weapon, that it obviously has taken out a large number of al-Qaeda senior leadership, and it also makes it harder for al-Qaeda to train and to plot and plan in those areas in Pakistan. But one of his closest advisors said to me that the way the president sees these things is that he is thinking about taking out the next terrorist who plans to attack Times Square or who may be planning to take out a civilian airliner. Presidents obviously have to think about these issues in very kind of concrete, tangible terms as opposed to just the kind of 30,000 feet view about how do you end this war, how do you deal with this larger problem. And I think that's also what has made this seductive to Barack Obama.
Well, there's another piece of that seduction of Barack Obama that I think we would be that behooves us to talk about, and that is the political piece of this. I mean, it's certainly important, if not elemental, for President Obama to be tough in the wake of the onslaught of Republicans focusing on weakness against national security problems. I mean, the president has pretty much presented himself now as a pretty tough character when it comes to the war on terror.
Look, I don't want to suggest that there's any element of hypocrisy here, but if you go back to the one speech that Obama made during the campaign, which was in July of 2007, the one speech on counterterrorism, that speech was very carefully crafted to make Obama look tough on national security and terrorism. Obviously, for generations, Democrats have been cast as soft on terrorism and soft on national security. They understood that Obama, as a former community organizer and a Iraq war opponent, that he was vulnerable in that sense. And although in that speech he talked about values and he talked about kind of rolling back the more controversial Bush-Cheney policies, his advisors were very careful to make sure he looked tough in terms of going after the terrorists. And if you go back and look at that speech, one of the things he said was, I want to ensure that the military is more agile, more stealthy, and more lethal in its ability to go after, to kill or capture terrorists. He was essentially talking about the drone program, which, by the way, he never opposed during the campaign. So yeah, there is a political element to this in some respects. I don't think that when he's making individual killing decisions, and his advisors are talking about how this makes him look tough and how this is going to be important going to the campaign. Although I will say that his former chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, was a big fan of the drone program, and he understood that it had political benefits.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of political craft in your book in terms of what's behind the scenes. You are to be commended just as a reporter for all that you were able to garner here and get about a program that's been pretty secretive, and I congratulate you on that. Again, Daniel Kleibman with us from New York, special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, and author of Killer Capture, The War on Terror and the Soul of the Obama Presidency. I can't get out of my head the picture of Eric Holder and Axelrod almost going into fisticuffs, among other scenes in your book that are political by nature. Thanks, Dan Kleibman. Good to have you with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to thank also Medea Benjamin, who was with us earlier, author of Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control, and Tom Hendrickson, whose most recent book is American Power After the Berlin Wall. We're going to shift gears as we normally do on Forum. In our next hour, we're going to be talking with Lewis Breger, who is both psychoanalyst and psychotherapist, about a book that really draws the subject into a different sphere and a different dimension. Thank you for being with us. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Judy Campbell and Christina Russo. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.